right, man, welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 679. It is me and Jason today, and we are going on to the world stage because all the world's a stage, and we are going to cover the character known as J. Edgar Hoover. An interesting lifetime, to say the very least. Jason has put together the notes, and believe it or not, this guy held office at the FBI for basically 50 years. I think it's actually a couple years short of that, but think about that alone. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a warm and rainy good morning.
You guys raining, huh? I called the nursery today because I'm getting ready to plant. They said, you better wait another 2 weeks to be sure the frost has passed. And I was like, man, what's going on around here?
I've been hearing stuff like that from the prepper channels I like to watch.
I mean, I watch the flowers to see when they come. I've done this for years. And this year, the two first ones came together. The third one happened during that. And tulips came, I don't know how many, you know, 7 weeks, 6 weeks early. They're already some of the tulips have already passed. It's unbelievable.
So this guy, man, he really did a lot of stuff in his lifetime. And I think it's the whole power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Not that he had literal absolute power, but he really wielded some power as the years went by with the FBI.
You know, it's crazy, Jason. On some of the lookups, I was given contradictory information in the very same paragraph. As an example of that, well, he was the fifth director of the FBI, and the very next sentence says he was the first director of the FBI. But think about what it means to hold that kind of power while he's expanding the power of this bureau, by the way, the whole time. And he's doing things that are not helpful to the citizens, which was known. Setting all that aside, this man held that post for basically half a century. It's unbelievable.
So that contradiction may have come from them renaming the Bureau of Investigation to the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Right. That's exactly where I landed. But when I see little things like that, it informs me. We're looking at a narrative. When I go on Wikipedia, I am looking at a narrative. This is the narrative that the mainstream puts out about how we're supposed to think about things. And how we think about things matters, which is exactly why I opened up saying all the world's a stage, because it is. And this character here was a significant one for, I think, 48 years is the exact number. And what he did, when they look in reverse, it's like he's a bigger criminal than probably most of the people he indicted.
But he wouldn't have seen it that way.
Like you said, power corrupts and absolute power absolutely corrupts, down to his supposed sexuality, which would have rung some bells back in this era. I think the 1940s is when that started to emerge. But anyhow, let's get into the meat and taters here and put this character on the world stage.
John Edgar Hoover was born on New Year's Day, 1895, in Washington, D.C., which turns out to be a city that he would never permanently leave. He rarely used John and went by Edgar or J. Edgar and was the youngest of four children. The Hoovers lived in what is called a modest but respectable home in the Seward Square neighborhood on Capitol Hill near Eastern Market. At the time, this was a predominantly white Protestant civil service area. His father worked as a printer and later chief of the printing division for the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey, which is a federal agency. His grandfather and other relatives also held government printing jobs, which made the family part of Washington's stable bureaucratic class. The Hoover household is said to have emphasized discipline, morality, hard work, and religious piety. The mother of the family, Annie, is described as the dominant figure, being affectionate yet demanding, and held strong Victorian values. She was the moral guide and disciplinarian. J. Edgar remained exceptionally close to her and lived with her in the family home until her death in 1938 when he was 43. His father suffered from severe depression later in life and was institutionalized for a time before passing away in 1921.
As we go along in the early descriptions here, you'll see that it's almost like this guy was exactly where he needed to be, hint, 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 to do what he did. But as the story develops, you're going to see some peculiar things that most of us would seem peculiar. One of the things you read in the bio was, oh, he loved dogs. And by the way, he was an aficionado. And by the way, he gave these dogs to a lot of famous people. Then they go on to say, oddly enough, he buried seven of them. But when you look at the mainstream narrative being laid down, there's quite a script to go from. Anyhow, Jason?
As a young boy, history says that J. Edgar developed a noticeable stutter, which emerged around first grade at Brent Elementary School. He was described as precocious in reading, but shy and self-conscious about his speech impediment. His father, Dickerson, reportedly hoped it would resolve on its own, but Annie took a more proactive approach. She sought specialists and pushed for solutions. Speech therapy in the early 1900s was quite rudimentary compared to later years, so the family relied on common home remedies and self-help techniques of the era. Young J. Edgar discovered, or perhaps was advised, that speaking more rapidly could help bypass the blocks and repetitions of his stuttering issue. He is said to have practiced relentlessly, often spending time alone in his room in front of a mirror for hours, sometimes even late into the night. His nieces occasionally overheard these sessions. This intense, self-directed practice became a hallmark of his personality, as he would go on to have single-minded determination and perfectionism. J. Edgar would largely overcome the stutter by speaking at a rapid, machine-gun-like pace. This speed style, the nickname he earned in some circles, stayed with him for the rest of his life. As an adult, he spoke so quickly that stenographers sometimes struggled to keep up. Occasional slips occurred under stress, but the rapid speech became one of his most recognizable traits, both as a tool for control and a lingering trace of the childhood challenge that he had conquered through his sheer willpower.
So think about this whole paragraph as a whole. Doesn't this seem strange when you're looking at someone, particularly at this level of importance, that much effort's going to be spent on this? So what I did is I just glanced at some clips of him speaking, because they're defining this as a hallmark. It was such a hallmark that he had rapid machine gun-like pace when he spoke. And to be honest with you, he does speak a little quickly at times, but it's nothing that I would have identified not having read this. And so when you look at these narratives, at least when I do, I begin to look for the fluff, and this is fluff. Why does this matter? If you're writing a biography, a biography on the man, then maybe you'll include a small part about this, but this kind of information pads in all over the place. Did you look at any clips of him speaking, Jason?
I had ages ago, but I didn't really pick up on anything either.
Yeah, I mean, they're acting like he spent, first of all, if you're going to say this was a childhood affliction and he spent hours as a child and spoke at a machine gun pace and that was a hallmark, that's going to linger on into adulthood. The reason I looked at the clips was to try to see if there were any stuttering clips. I didn't look very hard, but I didn't find any. My main point here is whenever we're reading about important people and I hit fluff like this, it tees me off more and more that I'm looking at a script of a character on a world stage. Not to say that this character isn't going to affect some things to happen, because certainly he does.
The King of England during World War II apparently also had a similar situation.
Right. And that was turned into a movie. But I think it's not too hard to find clips that would back the idea.
Shortly after graduating from Central High School in 1913, J. Edgar took a clerk position at the Library of Congress, working in the cataloging division, specifically the Order Division, processing and cataloging new books and documents. This work involved meticulous filing, indexing, and organizing vast amounts of information, which are skills that later proved to be invaluable to him when he built the FBI's centralized fingerprint and intelligence files. J. Edgar is said to have earned an entry-level clerk salary at first, but did receive raises over the years that he was there, and was working a standard government day shift. The job provided steady income and exposure to the inner workings of the federal government and was a stable, respectable government position that allowed him to support his family as his father's health was declining while pursuing higher education at night. The library's vast collections also gave J. Edgar early access to research materials on law, history, and government, which helped to feed his growing interest in legal and administrative systems.
I mean, talk about being where you need to be, going where we know he went. But if you look at these things logically, it's like almost anything that is a big deal in mainstream history. So wait a minute. grandpa was a printer, pops was a printer. Most people would expect he might, at least at some point, be a printer, but he goes the other way. Where does he land? Of course, in the Library of Congress. And in almost anything you look up on this man, they're going to show how much that lended itself to him becoming the head of the FBI.
J. Edgar began taking night classes at the George Washington University Law School, which was then called the Columbian University Law School, while working days at the library. He would earn his Bachelor of Laws, LLB, in 1916, with some sources noting that he completed requirements in 1916 and received the degree formally in 1917. This was an extremely demanding routine for him, as he was working a full-time day job and then attending evening classes and having to study late into the night. He often walked or took streetcars between the Library of Congress and the law school, which is located near what is now Foggy Bottom. J. Edgar is said to have been a solid, but not brilliant, student. He focused on practical subjects like administrative law, evidence, and criminal procedure. He was known for his rapid speaking style, of course, and his meticulous note-taking.
Hot damn, it's the Foggy Bottom boys. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Here's another thing. Just when you go through these things, what you would expect is not what you find. So he's holding down two jobs and he's going to law school at night, but he was a terrible student. That's not what you would expect when you read a backup like this. You would think this man's serious. He's not going to be a printer like everyone else in the family. And for some reason, he's going straight into law. Law is not easy. I don't know if anyone's ever looked into it. There was a point when I looked into the test of what it means to become a lawyer. It's very difficult stuff. And also, I know, I don't know, at least 5-6 people who became lawyers. And I don't think any of them passed the bar on their first go around. I even know a couple that went many, many times before passing the bar. My main point here is what we expect to see is often not what we see, which is the case here.
Yeah, somebody I knew took 4 attempts before he got past the bar exam.
Right. I mean, I would almost go so far as to say, if you're not a very good student, the last place you want to be is doing law, and particularly holding down other jobs and supposedly doing this at night.
The United States enters World War I on April 6, 1917, and in July of that year, a now 22-year-old J. Edgar leaves his clerk position at the Library of Congress to join the Department of Justice as a junior clerk in the Alien Enemy Bureau. His initial role involves administrative and clerical work related to the registration, tracking, and internment of enemy aliens, primarily German nationals and naturalized Germans living in the United States. This includes processing paperwork, maintaining files, and assisting with the growing wartime security apparatus. The work will be meticulous, bureaucratic, and highly centralized, all of which are skills that align perfectly with the organizational talents he had developed at the Library of Congress.
And more than that, they'll lend themselves beautifully to teaching you how to treat human beings as if they are not. And luckily, this was focused on a particular nationality that's always given us trouble here at home, the Germans. Well, I'm half German. I guess I could have been focused on back then. My point here is when you read about these things, it's, man, this guy's foot lands right where it needs to be. He's already in the Department of Justice at age 22, even though he's only a lowly clerk. But it gets better.
J. Edgar is considered draft exempt during World War I. The official reason is that he was the primary financial and emotional support for his family. His father was still suffering from severe depression and had been largely incapacitated, and his mother was relying heavily on J. Edgar as the responsible son who was still living at home. His draft exemption allowed him to continue working in the DOJ without any sort of interruption. Some later critics and biographers have noted that J. Edgar's rapid rise was occurring while many of his contemporaries were serving overseas, but there is said to be no evidence that he actively sought to avoid service beyond the legitimate family support exemption.
All right, whatever you want to say. I mean, here's the big patriotic position, head of the FBI, and everyone he knows serves, but he doesn't. Set that aside, I don't think you can argue that if any of this is true, the men that were his age, they were gone. All of them, as the war kicked on. So, I mean, it's like I said, his foot is falling on the exact step it needs to be to go where he's going.
In January of 1919, Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, who was considered an ambitious Democrat and a rising star who was hoping to run for president, appoints J. Edgar as his special assistant. His new title is Special Assistant to the Attorney General for the Alien Enemy Bureau and Related Radical Activities. This gives him another bump in pay, now earning significantly more than his Library of Congress or early DOJ clerk pay. Palmer is said to have chosen J. Edgar because of his proven organizational skills, attention to detail, and loyalty shown during his earlier wartime clerk work in the Alien Enemy Bureau. This appointment comes as the first Red Scare begins that same year, with widespread fear of anarchism, communism, and radical labor movements after the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. This occurs as there are bombings, strikes, and post-war unrest in the United States.
I say this the same way. Every time you read it, it looks the same. Does everyone remember Charlie and the Chocolate Factory? Well, seems like old Edgar held the golden ticket. There it is, right there. He didn't just put his foot on the right step. He jumped over about 10 steps all of a sudden. And the other thing is we're getting the fear narrative. If you go back and look at any of the Red Scare footage that you can find, it's almost like it's in a parallel universe. I mean, it really is over the top. But the fear was palpable at the time, and it was put to very good use from Hollywood to Washington.
In April of 1919, at least 36 package bombs are discovered in the U.S. mail that are addressed to prominent politicians, businessmen, judges, and officials, which includes Attorney General Palmer, Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., John D. Rockefeller, and others. One bomb reaches the home of former Senator Thomas Hardwick, which explodes, severely injuring his wife and blowing off the hands of his housekeeper. On June 2, 1919, a coordinated series of larger bombs detonate in 8 cities, which include Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. One bomb heavily damages Attorney General Palmer's home in Washington, D.C. Palmer is unharmed, but the bomber, who was an Italian anarchist named Carlo Baldinocci, accidentally blows himself up. At least one person, a night watchman, is known to be killed in the attacks. These attacks were carried out by Gallianists, who are followers of the Italian anarchist Luigi Galliani, who had been advocating propaganda of the deed, or violent direct action. Flyers accompanying the bombs declare war on capitalists and the government. The bombings create national panic and are widely blamed on anarchists, immigrants, and radicals, which provides political justification for the Palmer raids.
There's raids. They get to do raids. I wonder if anyone thought of that at the time, that this could really lend itself well to raids. I don't know how I'm going to say what I'm about to say, because you got to be careful when you're talking about things like this. And they're designed that way. When they're telling you that people were blown apart or lost their life, you are no longer allowed to ask a simple question. Is this staged? Is this a false flag? Is any portion of this real? Because a lot of things happen behind it. Even today, when we go back and look at things like Boston bombing, well, there's one that got ripped apart in real time on the internet before censorship was automated in real time. And guess what? You don't hear a lot about anymore, the Boston bombing. You just don't. If you look it up, it's not as prevalent as some of the other things. So to ride the middle line safely, just look at a few of the names of those involved. Oh, there's one, a Rockefeller. We all know what we know.
Are you trying to say that the Rockefellers were actually much more popular than we thought and that they wouldn't be the target of a bomb attack?
Well, one of the things that's striking here is we don't have Islamic terrorists yet, so it's those darn Italians, right?
1919 also sees an unprecedented wave of strikes as workers are demanding better conditions, higher wages, and union recognition after wartime inflation and post-war economic dislocation. There's the Seattle General Strike in February of 1919, which is the first citywide general strike in U.S. history, with over 60,000 workers walking out in solidarity with shipyard workers. On September 9th, 1919, there is the Boston police strike, with nearly three quarters of Boston's police force striking for union recognition and better pay. Riots and looting follow the strike, with Governor Calvin Coolidge famously calling in the state militia, which breaks the strike and declaring, "There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, anytime." This event catapults Coolidge to national prominence. Also in September of 1919, there is the steel strike, which involves over 350,000 steelworkers demanding better wages and an end to 12-hour shifts, which ends up being violently suppressed. In November of 1919, there is the coal strike, with hundreds of thousands of coal miners striking, which leads to federal intervention. Other major actions around this time include strikes by actors, longshoremen, and railroad workers. These strikes will often be portrayed in the press as influenced by radical or Bolshevik elements, which heightens fears of revolution.
And there you can see the script being read. Really? Bolsheviks got at, let's see here, they got at the Boston police. I'm not even going to do it. The coal workers, it's ridiculous. And this is how you begin to detect the nature of what we're reading about. But what you can deduce is if there was this many, this is hundreds of thousands of people actually striking, I think you can probably come to the conclusion the conditions were bad. In the last one, they're saying we don't want 12-hour shifts. Some of them, they're saying we want more safety. Meanwhile, you've got a guy who's supposedly becoming very popular, says you don't have the right to do that at any time for any reason. But here's what we know about the idea of unions, which is what this is. Truly the one thing the people on top, the robber barons, truly feared were the unions, because they could make a difference where the individuals could not. And no matter how you feel about it, that's just a fact. Years ago, when Jason and I did an episode, I looked up at the height of prosperity of this country. And at that time, it was, I forgot the number, Jason, I think it's 37% unionized. I'm pretty sure it's in the low or mid 30 percentile. But that just shows that where our prosperity was. From a personal point of view, I know that my father was a teacher and he died at home in his own bed because of his affiliation with that. It's not really the point. The point is, this is a boatload of people saying we've had enough. And the guy on top is saying, well, you don't have a right to do this anywhere, anytime. And to put the cherry on top of the cake, when is this happening? Ones and nines, baby. The computer does not miss a line of code. This is 1919. And the first one cited is, wait for it, September 9s. Those nines and ones are always in the code.
Well, what we're actually talking about here is towards the end of the reign of multiple robber barons. And yeah, the conditions were almost certainly atrocious.
Good point, Jason. Good point. You can go look at modern representations on places like HBO. There was a show put on my radar. Darn it, I can't remember the name. It's about the robber barons
of New
York. Yeah, the Gilded Age. Exactly. And they do here and there show in between the cracks about what's going on. You're basically looking at one rich guy on top acting like the government because he's got that much money. And of course, in that storyline, I think they do things like show what a human being he was because he didn't let people fire on the strikers and other things. But the truth is, there were some brutal, brutal conditions. If you want to look at things like the coal mines back in the day, it's almost unfathomable how bad it was in some of these places. Anyhow, Jason hit it. The robber barons are starting to lose their grip. Unions are coming online and hundreds of thousands of people are starting to demand better. As the guy on top says, well, you can't do these things for any reason at any time.
On top of all of these events, the summer of 1919, which comes to be called the Red Summer, sees violent race riots in more than 30 cities, which includes Chicago as one of the worst, with 38 deaths, Elaine, Arkansas, and Washington, D.C., as well as others. Returning black soldiers were facing intensified racism, and competition for jobs and housing was sparking deadly clashes. Demobilization of millions of soldiers, high inflation, unemployment spikes, and the spread of radical ideas, which are said to have been inspired by the Russian Revolution, is creating a volatile mix. Many Americans feared that bombings, labor strikes, and racial violence are signaling the beginning of a communist-style uprising. Attorney General Palmer and his new young assistant, J. Edgar, used the bombings, strikes, and unrest as justification for aggressive action, which leads to the first Palmer raid on November 7, 1919. J. Edgar helps to plan and coordinate simultaneous raids in multiple cities that target the Union of Russian Workers, which is called a radical immigrant labor group. Over 1,000 people are arrested, many beaten, and hundreds held without warrants or charges. Then, on January 2, 1920, is the second and larger Palmer raid, which is called the most infamous operation. This involves coordinated raids in 33 cities across 23 states. J. Edgar was the principal organizer and operational director from Washington, D.C. Estimates vary, but around 3,000 to 10,000 people are said to be arrested. Official figures are lower, with many sources citing around 3,000 to 4,000 that are detained in the immediate sweeps. Targets include members of the Communist Party, Communist Labor Party, anarchists, and suspected radicals, many of whom are recent immigrants. Raids are conducted with little or no warrants. People are rounded up from homes, meeting halls, and workplaces. Many will be held for weeks or months without charges or access to lawyers. Conditions in some detention centers are said to be brutal. 24-year-old J. Edgar is stated to have played a central organizational role building the index files and pushing for broad enforcement. He personally reviewed thousands of cases, decided who would be deported, and worked closely with the Bureau of Immigration, which was then under the Department of Labor, to use immigration laws for mass deportations when criminal charges were weak or unavailable. This led to hundreds being ultimately deported, including prominent anarchists Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, who were shipped to Soviet Russia on the Red Ark, which is officially the USAT Buford. The vessel is a U.S. Army transport ship that is used in December of 1919 to deport 249 radical immigrants and political activists from the United States to Soviet Russia, and goes on to be one of the most famous symbols of the first Red Scare and the Palmer Raids. The Red Scare eventually subsides by mid-1920 due to public backlash against the raid's excesses, but it will leave a lasting imprint on J. Edgar's worldview, one in which he will come to see dissent, immigration, and radicalism as existential threats that would require constant surveillance.
Isn't it ironic that you're looking at this fear, and by the way, they always get a reaction when they play the race card and the fear card. And there are more cards, but these never, I don't think ever, cease to give them the conditions that they're going to get things done. We're looking at this beautiful America where we have rights and due process. And what happens? The exact opposite. There is no due process. It even claims he's deciding who gets deported, along with no charges held for weeks, bad conditions, beaten or killed. It's the exact opposite of what they're claiming to defend. And what happens when these cards they play that get played over and over and over get played and they get their reaction and their fear and their uprising and their violence? Well, they broaden their powers. As further irony, look what's gone on in Europe right now. It's almost the polar opposite of this play card. Back then it was, you've got to be afraid of these people that don't look quite like you. So we're going to do all these things. Now it's, what's wrong with you? Just because they don't look like you, we're bringing them in. You can go look at video after video in Europe right now about the reverse of this idea being implemented for very similar reasons. People in a place somewhere of power want to get something done. Every time you see these cards play, you should quit looking at the card and look at what's being done because the card has been played.
As stated, the Palmer raids involved warrantless arrests, beatings, prolonged detention without charges, and denial of counsel. It turns out that many of the arrested individuals were not radicals at all. Some were simply immigrants who attended a meeting or owned a book. This will be documented in the 1920 Senate Judiciary Committee report, as well as the landmark book, the Palmer raids. In congressional testimony and internal memos, J. Edgar defends the operations as necessary to protect the country from revolution, claiming that the raids prevented a planned uprising. The raids were widely criticized, even at the time. Prominent lawyers, including future Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, condemned them as unconstitutional. Public opinion eventually turns against both Palmer and J. Edgar. Palmer's presidential ambitions collapse as a result, but J. Edgar survives unscathed and even gains some influence. This experience gives J. Edgar invaluable training in large-scale intelligence gathering, political surveillance, and using administrative power to neutralize perceived threats. He learns how to build and maintain secret files on thousands of individuals, which is a system that he would perfect and expand for the next 5 decades. The Palmer raids also taught him the value of operating quietly from behind the scenes while letting others, in this case Palmer, to take public credit or blame. It also instills, or perhaps reinforces, his lifelong belief that radical ideologies and immigrant communities pose an existential danger to the United States.
So on the one hand, I love this country. We have freedoms and rights, and then everything you do is the exact reciprocal of that. I would not be surprised if Edgar himself named Palmer as the way this would be remembered. But why is J. Edgar walking away unscathed? How can that be? We will get to that. And this is not only going on in real time, it's causing some of the most horrific things you can imagine to this day. It is a tactic that has apparently become universal. And we wonder, is this the guy who made it famous in the day? Wouldn't surprise me. We'll get to it.
On August 21st, 1921, J. Edgar is promoted to Assistant Director of the Bureau of Investigation. In this role, he is given broader administrative responsibilities while he continues to focus on intelligence and radical activities. J. Edgar reports directly to the director and is helping to professionalize operations behind the scenes. He is also cultivating relationships with key officials and begins building the network of loyalty that would sustain him in the decades to come. From 1921 to 1924, the Bureau of Investigation, under Director William J. Burns, who had been appointed in 1921, becomes entangled in the corruption scandals of the Harding administration, like the Teapot Dome scandal, as well as illegal liquor permits, among others. Director Burns is seen as politically compromised and ineffective. J. Edgar quietly distances himself from the worst of the scandals, while at the same time positioning himself as a clean and efficient reformer. He continues expanding the GID's files and advocates for merit-based hiring and scientific policing methods. By early 1924, the BOI was in disrepute. President Calvin Coolidge, who succeeds the scandal-plagued Harding after his death in 1923, seeks reform.
Oh, please. I mean, I've still got a couple cells. You know, rewrite the script here, guys. It's not working logically. So first of all, he's not just got his foot on the right step. For the second time, he jumps 10 steps for some reason. He has the golden ticket. But you're told all these horrible things and it takes down the director. But J. Edgar quietly distances himself. I'm calling poppycock. And I'll spill the beans that we'll get to later. He's doing what shows up in the Epstein files as a cause. He's got film of people doing things and photos, and he's got data that he blackmails everyone with. I wouldn't be surprised to learn he's the guy who made this a popular thing to do into the modern time, though I don't know that. So why wouldn't we wonder if he was directly responsible for this other director getting the shaft? It wouldn't surprise me in the least, but you don't jump 10 steps and become second in command and then somehow distance yourself from the first in command. It's a ludicrous thing to believe what's written here.
On May 10th, 1924, Attorney General Harlan Fiske Stone, who was appointed by President Coolidge, fires William J. Burns and appoints the now 29-year-old J. Edgar Hoover as acting director of the Bureau of Investigation. J. Edgar is confirmed as permanent director later on in 1924. He immediately begins his famous reforms, such as firing political appointees, instituting rigorous background checks, and training for agents, emphasizing merit over patronage, and expanding the use of fingerprints and scientific methods. He also creates a massive card index system for tracking radicals, criminals, and subversives. These would be an expansion of the files that he had started during the Palmer raids. By the late 1920s, the borough has become smaller, but is said to be far more disciplined and professional than it had been under previous directors. From here, he will build the mythic public image that will protect him for the rest of his life.
And how did he do it? Well, I like to say the golden ticket. So in May of 1924, he's magically watches his boss get knocked off the docket. He was number two in charge. How could it be that he wasn't involved in what his boss was? How could that be? Anyhow, boss gets the boot, and at 29 years old, holding his golden ticket, he becomes the acting director. But wait, there's an exclamation point on the end of this sentence. In the same year, he is confirmed as, wait for it, permanent director. Talk about un-American. I can't really imagine a thing more un-American than appointing a law enforcement individual for life. Just saying. But there it is. He's on top now with his golden ticket, and he's got the crown for life.
As we get into the 1930s, the Great Depression, which had started in October of 1929 with what is called the Great Crash of Wall Street, creates economic desperation for tens of millions of people. Bank robberies, kidnappings, and gang violence explode, especially in the Midwest. Local police are often under-resourced, corrupt, or outgunned in many instances. Gangsters such as Babyface Nelson, Bonnie and Clyde, John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, and Ma Barker's gang became folk anti-heroes. They rob banks, which are seen by some as striking back at the system that had caused the Great Depression, while using fast cars and Thompson submachine guns. The Kansas City Massacre, that takes place on June 17, 1933, sees gangsters killing four lawmen, including a borough agent, which acts as a turning point. This event generates massive public outrage and gives J. Edgar political leverage to expand federal powers. Congress responds with new laws in 1934, such as the Lindbergh kidnapping law, which makes interstate flight to avoid prosecution a federal crime, and laws that allow FBI agents to carry weapons and make arrests. From here, the period of 1933 to 1936 is considered J. Edgar's War on Crime campaign. On July 1st, 1935, the BOI is officially renamed to the FBI.
Well, boy, was a little tired. It needed to get more exciting, and they just did that. Now we've got our anti-heroes on the stage, the ones we all love to love or love to hate or whatever it is, you know, the gangsters that made so many movies. Hint, 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 hint. But what goes on during this period of time? What always goes on? The expansion of power. I wasn't even aware that apparently, Jason, they couldn't make arrests before this year. Is that what you drew from this?
Right. I learned that doing this research.
So 34. So what was the Federal Bureau doing up to 34? And I'm a little confused here because we were just told they went into 10 cities and grabbed all these probably innocent people and deported them and jailed them and beat them and did all these horrible things. They didn't have the power to arrest people and all that went down. I'm just saying, someone needs to go back through this script and rewrite it because this movie is not flying logically. Anyhow, Jason, let's carry on.
Getting into the War on Crime campaign, J. Edgar declares war on public enemies and turns the FBI into the lead federal agency against them. Key events and figures of the campaign include Babyface Nelson, real name Lester Gillis, who is an extremely violent member of the John Dillinger gang. He kills three FBI agents and dies in a shootout on November 27, 1934. There are Bonnie and Clyde, who are ambushed and killed by law enforcement with FBI involvement in Louisiana on May 23rd, 1934. There's John Dillinger himself, called Public Enemy Number One, who escapes jail multiple times, robs banks, and kills several people. He is killed by FBI agents outside the Biograph Theater in Chicago on July 22, 1934. There is also Pretty Boy Floyd, who was linked to the Kansas City Massacre, and is killed by agents on October 22, 1934. And there is Ma Barker and her gang, Machine Gun Kelly, and others who were also hunted down. The campaign is short, but is considered intense, with most of the major public enemies ending up either dead or captured by the end of 1934. J. Edgar uses these victories to justify more funding, jurisdiction, and authority.
There it is. You play the fear card, you play the race card, you play your cards, and like clockwork, there's more money, there's more jurisdiction, there's more authority. But the interesting question here is I bet I could ask anyone listening for the top names of everyone in the FBI or maybe any bureau in Washington of this time, and you're probably not going to know a single one of them. But everybody knows Babyface Nelson, John Dillinger, Bonnie and Clyde, Pretty Boy Floyd, Machine Gun Kelly, that name's still in heavy rotation, and Ma Barker, right? The branding is genius. And that may sound a little blunt, but how many movies have been made about the very names that I just rattled off so blithely, which were supposedly criminals in our country doing things that the authorities didn't like? It's the point I'm getting at. It's a form of branding to put your storyline forward, to get things in a direction where you can do what? Well, Jason ended the sentence with it. Funding, jurisdiction, and authority.
Next, we will cover the birth of the G-Men image, which J. Edgar deliberately crafts as a heroic public narrative. He works closely with reporters and authorizes books like 10,000 Public Enemies, published in 1935, which is a true crime book that details the FBI's early battles against 1930s gangsters. It is written by Courtney Riley Cooper and has a foreword by J. Edgar himself. Courtney Riley Cooper was a noted author and journalist of the time who worked closely with J. Edgar to publicize the work of the Justice Department. J. Edgar also feeds dramatic stories to the press, emphasizing FBI science, discipline, and bravery. Hollywood also gets in on the game, an example of which is the 1935 Warner Brothers film G-Men. The film stars James Cagney as a tough federal agent and turns out to be a huge hit. J. Edgar, of course, cooperates with studios to ensure positive portrayals. Other films would follow that follow the crime doesn't pay formula. There were also radio shows like G-Men and Gangbusters, plus comic strips and pulp magazines, all of which glorify FBI agents. The term G-Man, used extensively at this time, was originally underworld slang for any government agent, sometimes used derisively, that J. Edgar and the media repurposed to exclusively refer to FBI agents. By 1935, the term symbolizes elite and fearless federal crime fighters. J. Edgar insists that his agents look professional and are to wear dark suits, white shirts, and fedoras, and are to maintain strict moral standards. This contrasts sharply with the flamboyant gangsters of the era and creates a powerful good guys in suits archetype. The high-profile successes at this time legitimize the FBI as a modern, scientific force and will give J. Edgar immense political capital. He then uses this positive publicity to protect the borough from budget cuts and oversight. The G-Men myth makes him nearly untouchable for decades. While the public loves the image, the reality includes selective enforcement, such as slow action against the mafia until later on, and the beginning of political surveillance that would later explode into COINTELPRO.
And did you catch the word? One of the last sentences there, the G-Men myth. They openly say it, but it's one of those words most people will breeze across because we've seen way too many movies and read way too many books about this, so it must be real. But here in the open mainstream research, they refer to it correctly as a G-Man myth. And the reason for that is because what actually occurred doesn't look anything like what's been portrayed. And what we see more than anything here is this man has apparently got the marketing down. He knows how to get the names, the labels. Now he's got movies going up. Oh, he's doing the foreword in a book. He's getting all the information systems lined up, backing up where he's trying to go. But there it is, from the words of their own sources, the G-Men myth.
From 1935 through 1937, the remaining high-profile gangsters are either captured or killed. There is Alvin Creepy Karpis, who was the last major public enemy, being arrested in 1936. For this one, J. Edgar personally flies to the city of St. Paul, Minnesota, to be photographed with him in custody, and is one of the most famous publicity shots of his career. The G-Men image reaches its peak at this time. Movies, radio dramas, comic strips, and magazine covers portray FBI agents as clean-cut, scientific heroes. J. Edgar continues to cultivate relationships with Hollywood studios and friendly journalists to control the narrative. Public approval for the FBI and J. Edgar himself is extremely high. Polls and fan mail pour in, with J. Edgar becoming a celebrity in his own right. With the gangster era beginning to wind down, J. Edgar begins to quietly redirect resources toward internal security.
Internal security, huh? Gotta watch your own guys because you're up to things that could be trouble. The only example that I can recall for what I'm about to say is in the movie Robert Downey Jr. did of Charlie Chaplin. The amount of control and pressure he put on the movie makers, on the news people, it's almost impossible to look at. But if I remember correctly, in the Chaplin movie with Downey Jr., there's a scene or two that show him going into Hollywood and not really being much of a threat. But basically, this man is targeting anyone he wants with the resources behind it. He's got the branding down. He's playing every angle you could to make the FBI clean-cut Americans while they go out and, as we've read so far, violate rights or do any number of things. My point being, he gets information on anyone he thinks is going to be a problem. And at the end of this bullet point, he's focusing that power on his internal security. In other words, the others in the FBI could become a problem for him.
In 1936, President Franklin D. Roosevelt secretly authorizes the FBI to investigate subversive activities, particularly communism and fascism. This is done via verbal order rather than written directive, which gives J. Edgar broad latitude. With this directive, he expands the FBI's intelligence files on suspected radicals, labor unions, journalists, academics, and even some members of Congress. He creates a new domestic intelligence division and begins to monitor the German-American Bund, which is a pro-Nazi group, along with Italian fascists and American communists. This is the direct precursor to the massive domestic surveillance programs of World War II and the following Cold War. Even in this heroic period, however, J. Edgar was already using the FBI for political intelligence. He shares selective information with the White House while keeping his own secret files on powerful figures, which included FDR's inner circle. Wisely, he is careful to maintain plausible deniability and loyalty to the president.
I mean, if you read this one paragraph alone, how can you walk away with anything more than these guys got all the power they could ask for and they're not following any rules at all? They don't give a damn about the rights of America and who they're supposed to be surveilling. For that matter, they're looking for creepy videos of the people that don't agree with them, particularly if you're in the wrong political party. And to make it worse, the guy on top, or the supposed top, Roosevelt, is doing almost what the Pope did with the Jesuits, getting his own little private army behind his one party and his seat at the big table. It's all quite a bit much to look at. Meanwhile, he's cultivated in the movies, in the books, everywhere else, how clean cut and professional and scientific the FBI actually is. It's quite a thing.
1938 and 1939 mark a transition period for J. Edgar and his FBI. While the public still celebrates the G-Men as gangster fighters, he is quietly pivoting the borough toward internal security, counter-espionage, and political intelligence in anticipation of war in Europe. By the time Germany invades Poland in September of 1939, the FBI is already positioned as the lead agency for domestic defense on the home front. J. Edgar fights hard to keep domestic intelligence and counter-espionage under FBI control, rather than military intelligence or other agencies, and largely succeeds. By 1939, FDR informally designates the FBI as the primary civilian agency for these matters, giving J. Edgar significant autonomy. And so, the FBI begins developing plans for wartime mobilization. These plans include making lists of potential saboteurs and enemy aliens that are to be watched or detained, coordination with local police and military for plant protection, which includes factories, harbors, and power plants, and early work on loyalty investigations of government employees and defense industry workers. Publicly, J. Edgar is still continuing to emphasize the FBI's crime-fighting role. Privately, he is building the infrastructure for the massive domestic surveillance program that will explode after the Pearl Harbor attack in 1941.
I don't think it will ever be quantified how much damage to the idea of freedom and rights things like World War I and World War II did. World War I changed the trajectory of the world. And is there anything World War II didn't change? I mean, look at what's written here in the mainstream narrative. What strikes me more than anything is he wants the FBI to have everything, the hammer and the nails on things inside the United States border. And who's he up against? Well, the military. Well, that's quite a thing to go up against. But what does it tell us? It tells us that the military-industrial complex that we're going to be warned about when Eisenhower leaves office in, I think, 45, not long from here, another 6 years maybe, is not yet that powerful, because a single man in the FBI with all the connections and the blackmailing and everything else does to hold power easily shuffles off the military pressure and gets the power he is after, almost autonomous power to surveil the United States. It's quite a thing.
In June of 1940, the Alien Registration Act, also known as the Smith Act, is passed. It requires all non-citizens over the age of 14 to register and be fingerprinted, which is a massive program being administered by the FBI and INS. Over 5 million aliens are registered, creating a huge database that J. Edgar and his agents can use for security screening. The FBI begins compiling detailed custodial detention lists of people to be watched or detained in case of war. As we move into 1941, the FBI's counter-espionage work is intensifying. Agents are investigating suspected German, Italian, and Japanese spies and saboteurs that may be operating in the U.S. J. Edgar is pushing for greater centralization of intelligence. He also resists sharing raw data with other agencies, preferring to control the flow of information himself. The borough expands its technical capabilities, utilizing such things as wiretaps, surveillance, and informants, and begins loyalty investigations of government employees and defense contractors. Much of the surveillance that they conduct is done so with minimal judicial oversight. The FBI uses warrantless wiretaps and black bag jobs, which are surreptitious entries against suspected subversives, which are practices that would later be ruled illegal, but are widespread at this time.
That's a hell of a definition for black bag jobs. I would say what that means to me is they literally snatch someone and put a black bag over their head. That's what it used to mean. But anyhow, when you look at what's going on here in this one bullet point alone, it is not hard to imagine. If you were in a place to predict the future back then, would it be hard for you to imagine that we're going digital and we're going to be all computers? The more I see things like this, I mean, it was planned. And why? What's the key thing they're getting here? Information, right? That's what they're doing. They're collecting fingerprints and doing all these things for probably the first time in mass but it's all about the information. And when we first got computers, we had to work at it to figure out how they would benefit a so-called consumer so they would buy them. But from the get-go, what computers did really well was databases and spreadsheets, baby. I mean, they figured out ways that you could make your own card at home for birthday parties and other things. But at first, they needed more ways to make a computer useful. The point being, any other product would have had to be much more useful than that was when it first came on the market. This was an intended trajectory to get us to where we are now in the so-called disinformation age. And you can see why when we see points like this. All the way back in the 40s, they are doing everything they can to collect data, fingerprints, pictures, information, informants, all pointing to the same thing. But there it is, Jason. Anything you want to add on the tail end of hour one?
Well, in hour two, we're going to be getting into all the crazy stuff that goes on during World War II and then the Cold War, at which point J. Edgar's power is quite extensive. And then all the terrible things that go down in the 1960s with the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement.
You know, there's a strange thing about the energy changes that are going on all around us right now. And I kind of feel like 10 years ago or 15 years ago, someone reading what we just read would have overlooked so much of what glares at me now. When you look at what we've read on a whole, you're saying this guy was the top cop, basically, in the country with federal backing. And he broke every rule and did every un-American thing, if that's even a concept, to do the things he did. And I think the further into the era we go, the more glaring these things that happened back then are going to be. And what underlines it is we all know 10, 20 years ago that these things were just overlooked. We're pulling from a mainstream narrative with most of these points, and it's been overlooked. And that's a big deal. Because I feel we're crossing into a new reality where things like this are no longer going to be overlooked. Anyhow, Jason, last shot. Anything more you want to add?
Well, to follow up on what you were saying, I was left with the impression that J. Edgar pretty much did whatever he felt like.
I agree. And I think the sad truth is that he could blackmail anyone he wanted. We've all got our secrets, and I think that's what he did. He just went and found what you're the most ashamed about, which is almost everybody living. And he got the information because he had the manpower and the technology at the time to do it and the power. And he held it over anyone's head who stood up against him. And when we read things like the Epstein files, we know there are whole secret police in this world that have been doing this right along. And it's so bad that we get the impression now that it's endemic, that the darkness that we see has infiltrated so many of the systems. But with that, we're going to wrap up hour one of 679. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the whole episode. Members get access to all the forums and comments sections. They get free access to the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon. And they get absolute or exclusive access to my solar work, which, by the way, tomorrow, as we record this, is the first possible telescope day that I've had, not even kidding. But when that picks up again, the membership here will have exclusive access. With that, we're going to take a short break. We're going to be back for hour two, and I'd like to wish everyone a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers. We'll be right back.
the enemy of knowing.